Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on RFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Hello and welcome to Heritage Matters, brought to you by the Southern Heritage Trust. I'm Dougal Stevenson, and in this program we find out what's happening at the Oamaru Victorian Festival next month. We meet an interesting character from Port Chalmers history, and we mark the centenary of the devastating Spanish flu pandemic. But first, the news. The Dunedin Prison Trust is hoping to raise about $500,000 to re-roof the historic building. The first stage of the refurbishment of the prison, restoring its frontage, has already been completed at a cost of $600,000. Now the trust needs between $400,000 and $550,000 to re-roof the building with slates from Europe. The work is expected to start by the middle of next year. The building has one tenant at the moment, Escape Dunedin, but no firm plans have been announced about uses for the rest of the building. The Prison Trust has resumed its Saturday morning tours of the prison. Another step towards preserving the ruins of Cargill's Castle has been taken, with a contract let to structural engineers and conservation specialists for a stabilisation plan for the building. The Cargill's Castle Trust is using several grants totaling $75,000 to undertake the assessment. It will then fundraise to do the work required to stabilise and weatherproof the building. The castle was designed by Francis Peter and built in 1877 for Edward Cargill, a businessman, Member of Parliament and former Mayor of Dunedin, the son of Dunedin founder William Cargill. The castle has a Category 1 listing with Heritage New Zealand, mainly because it's a surviving example of early concrete construction. Another is the Peter-designed St Dominic's Priory. The castle had several owners after Cargill's death in 1903 and was opened as a restaurant and cabaret in the 1930s by John Hutton, becoming popular with visiting servicemen during World War II. There is currently no public access to the site. The Presbyterian support-run elderly care facility Ross Home in Northeast Valley celebrated its centenary at Labour Weekend. The home was built on 10 acres of land donated by Sir John Ross, founder of the firm Ross and Glendinning, which, among other enterprises, started the Roslyn Woolen Mill in Kaikorai Valley Road. John Ross's wife laid the foundation stone, and the home was opened on the 5th of October, 1918, with 28 female residents, called inmates in those days. The iconic building on North Road has expanded over the years and now has accommodation for 124 residents. The Rosses were also major benefactors of Knox College. And as usual, we thank the Otago Daily Times for those stories. Oamaru's popular Victorian festival will be held next month, showcasing the history of the town and its legacy of stone buildings. The festival, which has been running for 23 years, is on from the 14th to the 18th of November. One of the organisers, Diane Lee, told Jane Edwards what the theme is for this year's festival.
The theme this year is Upstairs, Downstairs, but we're having a real focus on suffrage since it's 125 years since women in New Zealand got the vote. So we have got a couple of events that are focused on that, one being a meeting, and we're going to join the march. So we've got a bunch of young ladies organising that, and they've learnt lots of their history. So we've got a lot of local suffragette history of women in the area who signed a petition and were activists of the time. So this Upstairs Downstairs theme will be mainly in the schools program, where they're going to teach the children the difference in the classes, like the upstairs children would have been learnt reading, writing, behaving yourself. Downstairs they were polishing the silver and so forth. But we're also having some events where we're dividing it between an upstairs and a downstairs theme.
Now, people are being encouraged to dress up.
Oh, yes, definitely. The wardrobe will hire, the Oamaru Victorian wardrobe will hire outfits out down in Harbour Street in Oamaru. So you could just choose a couple of things like a hat and a skirt or so forth, or you can get a whole outfit. They have the most gorgeous ball outfits, all sorts of things. So they're open on Thursdays and Sundays. So you can hire from them or have a look and have a go yourself. It's not too hard to come up with a Victorian outfit.
And there's an historical fashion show at some point?
Yes, on the Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock, we've got a young lady from up north who is an amazing costumer and a local lady, and they're both young 30s, and they are trying to gather costumes so they can... it's informative, telling people about the different styles of fashion through the Victorian eras. So it's not a competition as such, just a parade to inform people about different styles of bustles and jackets and what people wore to different things. Also, what ladies wore underneath, because all the different layers, so they give instructions on how. It's really good.
And there are several walking tours that highlight aspects of Oamaru's history. Can you tell us about those?
Yes, Helen Stead has a huge knowledge of Oamaru history, and she'll be taking people on walking tours. She does a classical architecture walking tour. She will also do a cemetery tour if you wish her to. She has lots of information and likes to share it.
Besides Oamaru, visitors can also have a chance to go to the Totara Estate and Clark's Mill. What's the significance of those two places?
Yes, Totara Estate was the first freezing works in New Zealand, you could call it. It's where Thomas Bryden developed the idea of processing the meat, because we had many, many sheep in this country and too much meat and no one to eat it. So he developed the meat industry from the Totara Estates. The first sheep that went over to England came from the Totara area and they got slaughtered at Totara Estate. So that's a historic place now, and you can visit at any time, but they're having a few events down there, and they're going to be doing ploughman's lunches and scones and jam at a billy tea. So yes, Totara Estate. And Clark's Mill is going to have, they were the only working flour mill now, and they'll be having a day when the flour millers are working. So these are both south of Oamaru.
You're having a number of social events, including a temperance ball. I assume there'll be no alcohol served.
Oh, of course not, madam. No. Yes, no, there is a large number of people. That's their highlight of the year, is going to the ball. It's very much upstairs, and everyone dresses appropriately, and there's a lot of set dances. It's a wonderful event.
That was Diane Lee, one of the organisers of the Oamaru Victorian Festival next month. You can find out more information on the Victorian Heritage Celebrations website, vhc.co.nz. vhc.co.nz. From time to time, our programme focuses on Otago people who may not have changed the course of history here, but led lives of interest. Such a person is the subject of today's programme, as Judy Southworth explains.
Dr. William Henry Borrie practised as a general practitioner at Port Chalmers and later Dunedin City in the early 1900s. The calls on his services were so different from today's GP services that we thought his activities worth telling. William Henry Borrie, a second son of John Borrie, a settler of 1857, was born in Dunedin in 1871. After his education at Southland Boys High School, he entered the University of Otago Medical School in 1889. He completed his course at the University of Edinburgh, and at his graduation there in 1894, was a medalist in the practice of physic, the practice of medicine. He made two trips back to New Zealand before becoming an assistant in a rural practice in Yorkshire. Following this, he spent time in a busy London practice before becoming a house surgeon at Norfolk and Norwich Hospital, then at Gravesend Hospital. He returned to Dunedin in 1899, planning to set up practice in the city, but the Port Chalmers doctor had died and Dr. Borrie agreed to do a locum for 6 months. He stayed 26 years. He built a substantial house and surgery there in 1908, and married in 1912. She was a graduate and the local Presbyterian minister's daughter. Port Chalmers was then a busy port, but the medical practice extended far beyond the town. It included Sawyers Bay, St Leonard's and Burke's, Deborah Bay and Arawana. It also extended over the hills to Haywards Point, Long Beach, Purukunui, Waitati, Evansdale, Warrington and the top of the Kilmog. Also included were the islands in the Otago Harbour and the Otago Peninsula from Larnach Castle north to Otago Heads. This included Broad Bay, Portobello, the military installations at Harrington Point, and on the ocean side, Hooper's Inlet, Cape Saunders, and Papanui Inlet. He had three telephones installed. The first was a general telephone, complete with handle and batteries. The second was the party line for night calls. And the third was a direct line to the Port Chalmers stables. This building still stands on the main street in Port Chalmers. When the phone rang, his family report that his wife could tell from his prepositions where he was called to. I'll come down, Deborah Bay or beyond. I'll come out, Sawyers Bay. I'll come around, Port Chalmers or Carey's Bay. I'll come over, the Waitati area. I'll come across, Portobello or elsewhere on the peninsula. If the latter, he would phone for the launch or, if rough weather, the larger SS Tarawai. For Port Chalmers calls, he would use the third phone to the stable asking for the horse to be saddled for him to collect. Occasionally, if the weather was bad and he was prevented from returning to Port Chalmers, he'd ask for a bed at the patient's house. He kept a horse at Portobello where he had a weekly afternoon clinic. The horse would be waiting for him when he crossed. When he was ready to return, he'd slap the horse's neck and say, "Now go home." The horse returned to the village. He was medical officer in the Māori settlement at Otakau. When he later left the area, the Māori showed their appreciation by the presentation of a silver-plated kiwi on a greenstone base and a rare Māori feather cape. He was a common sight. Leggings, waterproof coat and black bag containing Lysol, chloroform and mask, obstetrics, forceps and drugs in a silver case. Dr. Borry was also port health officer and was called often to clear an overseas ship. This meant a walk to the harbour, a journey in an open launch, scrambling up the side of the ship on a rope ladder, and inspecting every person aboard. Any suspects were taken to Quarantine Island nearby. The dwelling and surgery in Curry Street was gaslit and gas-heated. Some years later, electricity became available and was installed. Port Chalmers also had a small cottage hospital, which included a maternity section, and Dr. Borry, along with his partner, Dr. Hodges, also attended here. In 1910, they shared the purchase of a single-cylinder, 8-horsepower Rover car. With its quilted leather seat, brass-handled gate gear levers on the outside step, a large brass horn with a big rubber bulb, brass acetylene headlights, a small black boot and acetylene taillights, it was well known in the area. Imported from England by Cook Howelson, Dr. Borry drove it home to Port Chalmers. No driving lesson, no licence, no warrant of fitness and no road code. The chugging Rover was said to frighten people, horses, cows and dogs off the road. Dr. Hodges seldom drove it. The usual transport routine was morning calls by horse and trap, afternoon calls by car, and night calls by horseback. His son John recalled one hazardous trip by horse and trap.
My elder sister often accompanied my father. One day, returning to Port Chalmers in the horse and trap across the upper railway bridge, the left wheel came off, and my father, sister, and groom landed in a heap on the road with a box of apples all around them. The startled horse bolted and, dragging the trap on one wheel, shot across the railway line, tore up Curry Street, down Grey Street, around to Carey's Bay, and finally halted at Deborah Bay. The Rover could be equally hazardous. I vividly recall returning with Father down the hill from Waitati into Port Chalmers when the right wheel suddenly sped past us, and we settled suddenly on the road in a clutter of ball bearings running everywhere.
Further transport was added in the early 1920s when Dr. Borrie purchased a baby Triumph motorcycle, mainly for use in the Portobello area. He kept it at home but took it across to Portobello each Thursday for his clinic there. It once went on fire when travelling up the main street in Port Chalmers, but a local garage's fire extinguisher saved it. During World War I, the Port Chalmers Naval Volunteer Unit was stationed on the hills overlooking Harrington Point. They were visited twice weekly by Dr. Borrie. Quarantine Island became a military hospital base, and when smallpox broke out among the returning servicemen on the SS Waloka, all the patients were sent here. Dr. Borrie visited daily, and all but one of the patients recovered. Dr. Borrie left Port Chalmers in 1925 to begin 21 years of general practice in Dunedin. He died there in 1953. Dougal Stevenson read the excerpt from John Borrie. The programme owes much to the publication Growl You May, But Go You Must, a collection compiled by Sister Mary Damien in 1968 and published by A.H. and A.W. Reed. This is Judy Southworth for Heritage Matters.
The Ministry of Culture and Heritage is to erect a memorial to the 8,600 New Zealanders who died in the 1918 flu epidemic. It'll be set up at Pukeahu National War Memorial Park in Wellington in February. It's 100 years this month since the RMS Niagara arrived in Auckland with 26 cases of the so-called Spanish flu on board. The virus spread quickly throughout the country. The first death in Dunedin was reported on November the 4th, 1918. Anne Barraclough has more.
The flu pandemic that emerged in November 1918 was more virulent than any recorded before or since, killing more than 15 million people worldwide, 8,600 in New Zealand. It had a sudden onset, rapid progression, often with pneumonic complications, to death, sometimes within hours of onset, the patient often turning black shortly before death. It attacked most ferociously healthy young adult males aged 30 to 34 and females aged 25 to 29, and was seven times more devastating among the Maori, wiping out 4% of the Maori population. Coal mining districts, institutions, and military camps were worst affected. Una Rattray, a Dunedin girl returning on the mail steamer Niagara, told of her experience.
I had been at school in England for 3 years and had joined the Red Cross nursing convalescent soldiers. My mother and I were coming home to Dunedin. We crossed North America by train and stayed a while in Vancouver. There were no signs of any epidemic there. Just after Honolulu was the first any of the passengers knew of the flu outbreak. Many of the crew were laid low, and a few of the passengers as well. It was felt among those on board that the ship's doctor was very much to blame for not putting the first sailor who went down with it into isolation. So many of the stewards were down, they had to call on the passengers to help. We were all waiting on each other in the dining room. And I remember Mr. Massey and Sir Joseph Ward had the job of serving coffee in the lounge, which amused us all very much. Then 2 nights before we got to Auckland, a nurse who was returning from the war asked if anyone could help nurse the sick men. And since I had done nursing in England, I said I would. I spent 2 nights in the ship's hospital, which was right aft, and it was very rough those last few days. I well remember the horrible feeling of being left alone with 12 sailors, all very ill, with only one oil lamp swinging to and fro. There I was with all these delirious men, some calling out and trying to get up. There was nothing one could do for them except give them drinks and sponge them and keep them in bed. It was a horrifying experience, and it's stuck in my mind ever since.
That excerpt was read by Jenny Salmon. A third to half the population was affected. In some towns, numbers of sick reached two-thirds of the population, and in some areas, 80%. J.H. Carline of Dunedin experienced the first symptoms of the flu as the mayor read out the good news of the armistice.
While standing there listening, all of a sudden I felt ill and staggered back to my lodgings. I beat it off to bed. In the morning, a friend said he was going to get a doctor. I got such a fright that I jumped up, and then the blood just squirted out of my nose about 3 feet. Such was the pressure. I looked at my hands and my nails were black. The doctor said I'd be all right now after that loss of blood. Later that morning, one of the staff gave me a cup of tea. 3 o'clock that afternoon, she passed away. So devastating was this plague. After a few days, I was able to get up and wander about the streets. I can recall the emptiness, no shops open. The undertakers were flat out collecting the dead. At the station were railway carriages where the public filed through and were fumigated. But this was to no avail.
The reader was Bill Southworth. Within a week, the flu was in full spate from one end of the country to the other. The army camps fared the worst. Isolated mining areas such as Nightcaps fared almost as badly, while other districts escaped virtually unscathed. Lower death rates in Christchurch and Dunedin can be partially attributed to better organisation and slightly earlier warning, but institutions were badly hit. Jean Thompson talks of the effect of the flu at Seacliff Psychiatric Hospital.
I was charge sister of Ward 5, which held women patients. Flu hit the male side first, and to make matters worse, we had a week of misty weather coming in from the sea, which meant that the patients were confined indoors. 2 days later, I had 6 cases, fortunately all in single rooms. 2 days after that, I went down with it myself. I tried to keep going, but I had a temperature of 103 degrees and finally had to give in and go to bed. I tried to get up, but I fell on the floor. Another nurse had gone down by this time, and when Dr. Gray came on his rounds, he said, "I'm going to isolate all of you at the far end of the hospital." We had over 100 female patients ill with flu and lost only 8, plus Nurse Wilton. We always maintained it was thanks to Dr. Gray for isolating us promptly at the start. That was not more serious. On the male side, the flu cases were all put in the big hall. They had 314 male patients, though there were only 10 deaths. These cases had all been heavy drinkers in their freedom. Some of the male staff were also heavy drinkers, off duty, and they died too. During the epidemic, nearly all the female flu patients lost their hair. One nurse was completely bald. The nurse who slept next to me had caught the flu while on leave in Christchurch. Her hair fell out so fast she filled a shoebox in one day. That flu was an experience one does not easily forget.
The reader was Aimer Lyons. The worst rural deaths occurred in Otago and Southland. In Owaka, the onset was blamed on a special train that took crowds of revellers to Dunedin for the armistice celebrations in early November. In Tahakopa, only 12 people in a population of 186 escaped. In Dunedin, a family of 5 little girls was orphaned. The granddaughter of one of the girls, Maureen Smith, told their story.
Both my mother's parents, Tom and Annie Holt, died in hospital within an hour of each other. The oldest daughter, Ruby, was aged 7 and the youngest, Nellie, was only 11 months old. The hospital rang Sam Wilson, a taxi driver, to take the news to the family. 2 of Tom's sisters were looking after the girls at home in Melbourne Street, but they were taken to the orphanage run by the Sisters of Mercy in McAndrew Road for a few nights. Ruby was staying with Grandmother Holt. Annie's father, a stern, hard man, wanted the 5 girls sent to the industrial home. Grandmother Holt took the 3 youngest, while 2 of Tom's sisters took the 2 eldest girls. Then his 3 other sisters each took the 3 young ones, Phyllis, Edna, and Nellie. Uncle Jim, who lived in Clyde, wanted to adopt Nellie, but this was not allowed because he was a Catholic and the Holts were Presbyterian. All five girls kept in touch and were good friends all through life.
The reader was Judy Southworth. Schools, universities and many businesses were closed and public gatherings were cancelled. Hospitals were quickly overwhelmed with influenza and pneumonia patients, so emergency hospitals were quickly set up in church and school halls under canvas, and even a racecourse pavilion was used. Sid Muirhead of Oamaru told of the steps families took to treat the flu.
All around us, people were coming down with the flu. Formalin was used to a great extent at home, and our clothes were boiled in the copper and fumigated. I still remember pieces of cloth, usually cotton sheeting, being burnt and left to smoulder in the bedrooms. The smoke and the smell were intended to kill the bug, but how effective that was, I have no idea. My father arrived home from work earlier than usual, very flushed and running a high temperature. Dad indicated he could not eat or drink. He had lost his voice, but Mother insisted that he have a plate of gruel. Dad indicated he had a bottle of whiskey planted in a cupboard, and if she were to add some to the gruel, he would eat it. In all innocence, Mother tipped half the bottle of whiskey into the gruel. Dad drank it quickly and very soon broke out in a sweat. He perspired copiously, and the bedclothes had to be changed several times. His remarks on regaining his voice were quite incoherent for some time, but he made a quick recovery and always maintained that it was the quantity of whiskey and the shock and impact that brought this miraculous recovery.
The reader was Dominic Angelo Laloli. Many landlords heartlessly evicted tenants who had the flu, some convalescents returning from hospital to find their suitcases on the veranda and the door locked. Public feeling against slum landlords and sanitary inspectors ran high in areas like South Dunedin, where many houses still had pit toilets. The epidemic spurred on the completion of Dunedin's sewerage system. There was also public hostility towards many greengrocers who took advantage of the demand for fresh produce by hiking up prices. The Spanish flu epidemic started in Dunedin on November the 4th, 1918, and was finished by the 20th of December. The total admissions for Dunedin Hospital was 701, of which 530 were pneumonic. 172 died. I'm grateful to Geoffrey W. Rice and Warwick Brunton for their books Black November and The Medicine of the Future, from which most of the information came.
That report from Anne Barraclough. This program will be repeated next Sunday at 7 o'clock. It was brought to you by the Southern Heritage Trust.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of premier local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.